You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. The great Trinidadian intellectual C.L.R. James was a giant by any standard. An anti-colonial fighter, Marxist theoretician, journalist, and novelist. The author of the groundbreaking history of the Haitian Revolution, Black Jacobins, along with other works of left scholarship. James was also a journalist and aficionado of cricket, and a playwright whose work was performed in London, starring Paul Robeson. In the past several decades, since his death in 1989, at the age of 88, James has only grown in stature as an influence on the contemporary radical left, where he has been rediscovered by a new generation. As part of that reappraisal, a series of lectures have been published which give us a sense of his breadth of ideas and politics. The collection, You Don't Play with Revolution, The Montreal Lectures of C.L.R. James, is edited by David Austin and published by AK Press. David Austin is the co-founder of the Alfie Roberts Institute and the editor of A View for Freedom. Alfie Roberts speaks on the Caribbean, cricket, Montreal, and C.L.R. James. And David Austin is also author of a forthcoming book on Lyndon Kwesi Johnson. When I spoke to him yesterday by phone from Montreal, I asked him to tell us about C.L.R. James's background.
C.L.R. James was from Trinidad originally, and spent the first 31 years of his life in Trinidad, in Port of Spain for the most part, and some outlying districts. His father was a schoolmaster who trained James, prepared James at a very early age to study at Queen's Royal College, which was considered one of the elite schools, was one of the elite and remains one of the elite schools in Trinidad and Tobago, modeled for the most part after the British school system. James was a very precocious child, and his father wanted to prepare him for the Island Scholarship, which would allow a national kind of examination that would allow students who probably otherwise couldn't afford or wouldn't qualify to study at Queen's Royal College, to prepare them to study there. And James, being the very precocious student that he was, I think in his second year, qualified to study at Queen's Royal College and was quite young. And from a very early age, he was sort of looked upon as this precocious student who was supposed to do great things. And that's how his parents saw him, his father being the schoolmaster. And that's how his family and friends perceived him, too, I'd say. But I think it's important to say that even though I mentioned his father being the schoolmaster who prepared him to study, it was really his mother. It's from his mother that he acquired this love of reading. And as he talks about in the book Beyond the Boundary, which is a kind of semi-autobiography, which is largely about the sport of cricket, but also about a kind of philosophy of art and sport and its place in society. James says that as soon as his mother would put a book down, he would pick up that book. And, of course, he was reading mostly Western European classical literature and Shakespeare and a range of other kind of classical thinkers from Europe mostly at the time. And yeah, he was this young bibliophile that just loved to read. Now, there was another side of C.L.R. James, or many sides of C.L.R. James, you could say. And as he talks about again in Beyond the Boundary, and it's probably the book to suggest as a kind of introduction to James's formation, because it's, as I mentioned, it's quite biographical, autobiographical. He talks about this rebel that lives within him, and it has direct and a good deal of bearing on the person that he became, that on one level sort of embraced this kind of Western canon with all the literature and philosophy and the body of ideas that it involved, but in another kind of way rebelled against the kind of systematic institutionalization of it, in other words, the school system that propagated it. and, you know, basically became this kind of autodidact from a very young age, who, when he was supposed to be studying for exams, etc., was really teaching himself, and in some ways you could say even interpreting that same literature himself, you know, reading Thackeray, which he says he read over and over and over again, and books by Charles Dickens, Charlotte Bronte, and a range of European literature. And he essentially almost dropped out of school or failed out of school and didn't live up to the expectations of those who had supported him or who had followed his progress.
Well, you just mentioned cricket and its importance for C.L.R. James, which is one of the reasons why he ended up moving to the UK to report on cricket or write about cricket. But before you tell us about his work, what is the importance of cricket for the cultures of the Caribbean, for Trinidad?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to look at cricket like education in some ways, as for people who were formerly slaves or indentured laborers, sport became one of those vehicles through which you could achieve, you know, socially and professionally, and aspire to be something other than a descendant of a former slave and a colonial. And so it's not surprising that the Caribbean, that the West Indies would produce, and Trinidad would produce a number of first-class, world-class cricketers, because that became a vehicle, a channel for escaping the oppression of colonialism, right? It also became a vehicle. Now, some people would dispute this. Maybe there's people like Natasha Barnes and others who maybe would dispute this, but it also became a vehicle through which those who were colonized could almost, in a sense, adopt the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. And this becomes apparent in the 50s and 60s with the rise of West Indian cricket. Not only at the rise of West Indian cricket, but led and its key cricketers being not only West Indian, but also Black West Indian and Indo-West Indian, and you know, which marked which was a kind of departure from the earlier days, where international test cricketers were generally led by people who may be of white British origin, and many of the team's best players would not be many of the best players in a particular territory, colonial territory, would not necessarily be picked for the national team because of racial barriers and all kinds of other factors related to colonialism. So it became a way of demonstrating the viability of self-government and self-government and independence. Now James takes it a bit further and talks about cricket as an art form. You know, so he goes into quite a bit of detail about form. And draws on his knowledge of ancient Greece and the Olympics and the place of sports in society to talk about the place of sport, the potential for sport in the West Indies, but again as an art form in which, you know, the goal of winning, the goal of the game is not simply to win, but to win in a very particular kind of way that involves grace. I mean, beyond art, it also involves the various codes that were inherited from Britain, which kind of, you know, speak to how to conduct and comportment.
In the 1930s, when James moved to London, were a time of great ferment against colonialism and towards Pan-Africanism. And in 1935, fascist Italy invaded what is now Ethiopia, what was then Abyssinia, and James and others within the Caribbean and African diaspora mobilized in opposition to that invasion. Tell us about that moment, that time, the sort of ferment that was going on, James's place within it and within the notion of Pan-Africanism.
Sure. Well, that's a very interesting period for C.L.R. James and for people of African Caribbean descent in Britain at the time, and also in France and other places, but we'll speak mostly about Britain. Because James travels to England to become a writer. He has two books under his belt, the first being Minty Alley, which is a novel, which is considered really one of the first kind of groundbreaking books of fiction, at least from the English-speaking Caribbean, and was probably the first book to be published by a Caribbean author in England, at least a black Caribbean author in England, book of fiction, that is. And he also has a book about West Indian cricket, the life of Cipriani, who was a labor leader in Trinidad, which was published in a complete form, then in a bridge form as a kind of booklet called The Case of West Indies Self-Government. And now, so it's a book of fiction. There's a book that James writes, a kind of biographical, semi-biographical book about Captain Cipriani. And he's working as a cricket correspondent and ghostwrites Sir Larry Constantine, the Trinidadian cricketer who's playing county cricket in England at the time, ghostwrites his biography. So there are a couple of things going on there while at the same time he becomes immersed in British and international socialist politics, while at the same time being actively involved in Pan-African politics, while from time to time being called upon to talk about West Indies self-government. So it's an extremely active period for James, and it's the period which we begin to see how James becomes politically active in a number of different areas, which on the surface appear to be mutually exclusive. You know, so African politics separate from Caribbean politics, cricket separate from his socialist politics separated from his kind of evolving Pan-African worldview. But actually all, in James's mind, I think, would say very much connected. And definitely you could say that his work in kind of Pan-African circles also fused with his kind of socialist international work. And that becomes very apparent in the publication of the book, The Black Jacobins, Toussaint Louverture and the San Domingo Revolution, which is a book which on the surface, again, is about the Haitian Revolution and Toussaint Louverture, who was the principal leader of the Haiti's revolutionary process against France. But yet the book is riddled with lessons and examples of drawing from partly the Russian Revolution. So we get a sense from this history about the Haitian Revolution, you know, 18th, 19th century revolution, where he's drawing on the Haitian Revolution to make arguments about African independence, about the question of socialism. He draws heavily on the Russian Revolution and the thought of Lenin, in some respects comparing Lenin to Trotsky. So what I'm trying to say is that even though The Black Jacobins is often read as a book about the Haitian Revolution and about the African liberation struggle to come, which is not to say that that's not important, but it's actually more complex than that, because he weaves together his many lives, even as a writer. It's one of the most kind of literary histories that you can find. So much so that it's been described as the War and Peace, referring to Tolstoy, the War and Peace of the Caribbean. So to get a sense of the many lives that James led that were interconnected, The Black Jacobins, probably much more so, I would say much more so than the other book that he writes during that period, World Revolution, or the History of Negro Revolt, a separate book, a smaller book, to really get a sense of how the many lives that James led during that period are interconnected. The Black Jacobins is probably, in many ways, the place to start. Now, the other thing that's important, which you alluded to, is that now he's the book reflects the book. Each one of his book reflects his politics of the time. So James is not just writing about Africa through the Haitian Revolution. He's actively involved, working alongside both African and Caribbean Pan-Africanists like George Padmore. Nnamdi Azikiwe is kind of in and out of that process, and Jomo Kenyatta, and he's part of a group called the International African Service Bureau, which is founded by George Padmore, but which includes Amy Ashford Garvey. And after James moves to the United States and meets Kwame Nkrumah, who would later lead Ghana to independence, Nkrumah becomes part of that group. Upon the introduction by James, James introduces Padmore to Nkrumah to George Padmore when he migrates to England, and Padmore becomes a part of that group too. So James was not just sort of theoretically writing about African liberation. He was as close as you could be to that process from a distance, meaning in the metropole outside of the African continent. And we get that sense when we read The Black Jacobins, that he has some intimate insight into what is, even though he doesn't make detailed allusions, he has intimate insight to what's happening in the region. Of course, you know, between him and George Padmore, especially George Padmore, all kinds of news, all kinds of information related to African struggles in Africa and also struggles in the African diaspora are passing through. Padmore is reading this, you know, and writing about these developments, just as James, involved in the international socialist movement, is reading about and writing about developments in the world of socialism.
So in the 1930s, in this period that you've been discussing of Pan-Africanism, you mentioned James's socialism. James had initially, when he arrived in the UK, in England, had become involved in the Labour Party, but ended up gravitating to a more radical part of the left spectrum. Tell us about James's Trotskyism, which his work, World Revolution, 1917 to 1936, The Rise and Fall of the Communist International, which was published in 1937, epitomizes in some ways.
Well, that book in some ways is a bit of an anomaly, because James writes that book. Now, it's really interesting, and it speaks to the kind of person, the kind of intellectual, political person that James was, because James arrives in London, in England, in 1932. And within a few short years, he's not only moving in circles of socialists, but becomes, for all intents and purposes, you know, within the international, you know, within the IOP and in the Marxist group, and within, you know, within the Labour Party. But then, you know, this Marxist group is a kind of small, very kind of concentrated group of left thinkers who, in many, you know, after a certain while, after a certain moment, assert their independence. Right? And he becomes a leading Trotskyist, not only in England, but at a certain point in Europe, who, in writing this book, World Revolution, really writes what, you know, has been described as the Bible of the Communist International, definitely the Bible of Trotskyists, I should say, now the Communist International, which is this kind of sweeping account, this sweeping overview of the Communist International and the rise of Stalinism. Now, many people would probably say, and I can't go into, you know, details about the kind of, you know, pros and cons of those arguments, but many people would probably say that it's not James's best book. But in some ways, when you think about it in the context in which it was written, it's in some ways his most audacious book, because here is this man coming from this tiny island of Trinidad, which, you know, on the surface you would say, well, you know, how is it that James becomes this, you know, this world-renowned intellectual? But Trinidad is known for producing world-renowned intellectuals of all stripes, you know, fiction writers, you know, but James in many ways sort of laid the groundwork for that. Trinidad is also known for producing some of the leading kind of Pan-African figures, of which George Padmore was one, but, you know, you can go back to Henry Sylvester Williams, and, you know, so in some respects, Trinidad is a very unique place. But on the surface, of course, the question becomes, well, how is it that this person, you know, James, coming from Trinidad, shows up in England, and within a few years, he's one of the leading figures in the group, and writes this book that many people who see themselves as the inheritors of the Bolshevik Revolution, which is running astray because of Stalinism, they swear by this book as the book that's in many ways speaking to them and telling the story that needs to be told. And I think when we look at it from that context, the book is remarkable in that it's written by this person who, you know, within a few years of arriving in England is one of the leading spokespersons for Trotskyism, so much so that James is selected in 1938 to travel to Mexico via the United States to meet and deliberate with Leon Trotsky on a number of questions. Of course, international socialism, on what was described then as the so-called Negro question in the United States. And so was not only a Trotskyist, but became quite familiar personally with Leon Trotsky as a result of his stature within the Trotskyist movement, within the international Trotskyist movement.
And in the late 1930s, he actually relocates from the UK to the US, where he joins the Socialist Workers' Party, which is the American wing of the Trotskyist Fourth International.
That's right.
But then leaves the Socialist Workers' Party. And of course, the Trotskyist movement is rife with splits of various kinds, and C.L.R. James's trajectory is a little confusing in that he left the Socialist Workers' Party and forms the Workers' Party and the Johnson Forest tendency within it. They end up rejoining the Socialist Workers' Party in the late 40s. They then leave in 1949. But putting aside those twists and turns, tell us about the Johnson Forest tendency and what distinguished it in terms of the theories that C.L.R. James and his comrades put forth and their notions around strategy and organization.
Well, I think, and you kind of alluded to it already, but I think the main thing that distinguished the Johnson Forest tendency from its affiliated groups and both individuals within both the Socialist Workers' Party and the Workers' Party, which it was part of both at different points, as you mentioned, is the fact that it was so attracted to theory and felt that there was a need to kind of theorize what socialism was. There was a need to rethink the meaning of socialism. There was the need to rethink, not only to question the assumptions of Stalinism, but also to question the assumptions of Leon Trotsky, in including the idea that, you know, that Trotsky died with, that the Soviet Union, despite its lapses in degeneration, was, in fact, what he described as a degenerated worker state. In other words, it represented some form of socialism in some form or another, although it had deteriorated under the leadership of Stalin. And at a certain point, C.L.R. James, along with his close collaborators, Raya Dunayevskaya of Russian origin, and Grace Lee, later to be Grace Lee Boggs, an American of Chinese descent, they thought through some of those questions and in essence broke with Leon Trotsky, because they were no longer willing to accept the idea that you could describe in any shape or form the Soviet Union at that point as being socialist or socialistic or communist. And they put forth this notion that the Soviet Union was a form of state capitalism. In other words, it was a capitalist society that was led by the state. Okay, so it was not the same kind of free market enterprise with parliamentary democracy, but the same kind of attendant relationships between those who worked and those who managed, those who ran the state and those who were kind of the ordinary citizens, that in their bare essence, when you broke them down to their lowest common denominator, those same relationships and dynamics persisted. So that was, in many respects, the main theory, this notion of state capitalism that was developed by the Johnson Forest tendency. But outside of that, outside of the critique of both Stalinism and Trotskyism, which, by the way, is represented in theoretical terms in James's book, Notes on Dialectics, Hegel, Marx, and Lenin. That's the most recent title of the book. It's kind of essays that were penned by James in Nevada, Las Vegas, in 1948, where he's thinking through, drawing on Hegelian philosophy, on the ideas of Hegel. He's thinking through this notion of socialism and international socialism, what it means. And so he has this theoretical critique of both Stalinism and Trotsky in that book. But that leads to another point, and that is that this tiny group, which at its core, the triumvirate being James, Danievskaya, and Grace Lee, but there were several other people that were actively involved in its group. But it was a very tiny group within an already relatively small group. But despite its size, it published a number of books and pamphlets that, in terms of intellectual theoretical production, was way out of proportion to its size. And among its publications, this group was the first to publish what is now kind of standard reading in if you take a course on Marxism, or even the relationship between Hegel and Marx is kind of standard reading now, is Marx's Economic Philosophic Manuscripts, which is his early writings from the 1840s, where he's working out in theoretical terms what this thing called socialism and communism is. And they felt that they needed to go through this process of going back to the early Marx to kind of glean lessons from, you know, Marx's early utterances on socialism and communism, because within those writings there's a kind of dynamism and dynamic about movement, change, and possibilities, couched in a lot of theoretical language, which is also there in his much later writings, including Capital, but is kind of couched in more kind of economistic language, which kind of shields the dialectic that's embedded in it. So if we were to talk about this group's achievement, we would be talking less, I think, less in political terms and more in theoretical terms. And in addition to James, if we look at what people like Raya Denevskaya, for example, as well as Grace Lee Boggs, what they did, you know, as life went on, both within and later outside of the group, you know, these are two people that have been profoundly influential in various spheres. Raya Denevskaya in her analysis not only of Marxism but the dynamics between dynamics of gender, race, and class, particularly gender and class. And you know, Grace Lee Boggs became, you know, this is, you know, post Johnson Forest Tendency, very active in her community in Detroit. And today, Grace, I don't know, she must be in her late 80s, maybe in her 90s, is still extremely active. And just as an aside, her book Living for Change, which came out a few years back, is a very kind of insightful reflection on what social change means in our time today. And it draws on and kind of reflects on both her experience working in the Johnson Forest Tendency with C.L.R. James, as well as her future husband, James Lee Boggs.